Okay, as I said, tonight we are addressing what's come to be a sensitive topic. And that's why I brought in an expert to do the work. You'll hear, this is a person who put a lot of thought into Yiddishkeit b'chlal. So I just want to start. We're learning Kuzri. So we'll learn a couple of sentences in Kuzari. I'll say a couple of words before we'll ask Rabbeinu to take the floor. We saw last week, how the Chaver is telling the king of Kuzar, one of the wonders that Moshe Rabbeinu performed was that he was able to give a Torah that describes exactly how mankind developed, how the different nations developed, everything about what happened from the beginning of the world. So here the Kuzari asks the million-dollar question.
Omar HaKuzari, the king of Kuzar, says, Gam zeh teinu. This would be amazing. There's one question nobody can answer. How old exactly is the world? Do you know this also? You're saying that you have a Torah that tells you exactly what happened from the beginning? Omar HaKuzari, the Chaver says, Bayonu Mainim. Sure, based on the Torah, we count the years of the world. There is no dispute on this matter between any two Jews anywhere in the world in that time. Unfortunately, that's different. So Amar Kuzari, the Kuzari asks, the Kama Temoinimayim. He's amazed. So how old is the world? What are we up to now? Omer HaChover, and the Chover answers, 4,500 years old, which is about 1,300 years ago. Uprotam mevoyar b'sefer ha'chumash shalonu, imayis odam v'sheis v'enoish, v'ad noyach, ad shem v'ever, Ravon, Yitzchok, Yaakov, ad Moshe.
If you want to figure it out, you can simply go and count, making the cheshbon. Torah gives the exact number of years from Adam through the generations until Moshe. From then, we can figure it out ourselves. We work backwards. Okay, now of course, the big problem here is that modern scientists, I make a point of saying scientists, not science. Science is absolute things that can be seen in a laboratory. Scientists are saying that the world is actually a lot older than that. Now, this has been cause for confusion, and many people give a sigh of relief when you hear that there are Sfarim from which it comes out that actually perhaps the years of Rias Olam were not literal. Now, we're going to hear Rabbeinu address this, and this is a valid approach, but I want to say one thing before we begin the subject, and that is, I want to read a pasuk in Mishlei. Tachas sholesh rogzo eretz tachas arba leituchas eis. There are three things that the world trembles at, and then there's a fourth that it just can't tolerate. The last one is, number four, when a maid supplants her mistress. Meaning, you have the queen, and there's a black maidservant who's up till now was cleaning the basements. And somehow or the other, she managed to kick the queen out, and now she's sitting on the throne in her smelly rags. So the Malbim says, what's this referring to? Malbim says, "Shu eis yazer teras Hashem v'achokma mukubalis me'elikim." This is referring to the period in time when people will forsake the Torah of Hashem and the chokma, which we have received directly from the one who created it all. Sheyad vira be'emes. That's the queen. V'yivcha b'deres kolz vois mi'filosofia. Instead, he accepts all the claims of the scientists, philosophia, the philosophers, Tovus HaSeichel HaEnoshi, which is basically human conclusions. Now, of course, you know, science, if something can be proven in a laboratory, you can't dispute it. But the feeling that whatever the scientists say must be true, and that rush to prostrate ourselves, we have to start apologizing for the terror, now we have to back up. A Jew has to be able to have the backbone and say, I don't buy it so quickly. Everybody in the world could be saying something. Someone once told me, can you still be so idiotic to say that the world is 5,000 whatever years old? The Jew was always idiotic enough to be able to stand against things that the entire world said.
and what the entire world says switches every couple of hundred years. Now, if it'll turn out that you can show in the laboratory clearly that the world is a billion years old, the Torah won't conflict with that. The Torah won't conflict with that. But the fact that they say so, we know about analysis, and we know about intellectuality. There are sugyas. A chacham can analyze it, reach conclusions, and you say, I want to analyze it too. Another chacham comes and analyzes and finds holes in the first one's reasoning. Why do we have to rush to prostrate ourselves before the scientists and say, well, this is what they believe at? We have to go and start redefining the Torah. We have to be able to have the backbone and say, 1 minute, we can analyze the data for ourselves too. We're not so quick to assume that, yeah, you observed certain things, and that your conclusion is, maybe yes, maybe not. We're not so quick to drop it. Now, are there holes? That is a subject required of expertise. So we'll hear from the expert what there is to say on the matter.
Or at least you'll hear from me.
I guess the first thing that we should do is maybe the first thing we should do is maybe grab a poem before we get started on this particular inyan, and it goes like this. I asked Rav Mordechai Goldstein. We were learning a sugya in Maseches Nida where it describes a certain situation in biology that you know you can conduct a I'm not suggesting that you should, but you can cut open a corpse and find out that it's not true. So I went to Goldstein and I said, like, you know, what are the klalim for how you deal with these types of situations where you have a statement in Chazal and it gives you a description of, you know, something that l'chora isn't true? And he gave me, basically, he says there's three answers, and this is the order of preference for how the answers go. The preferred answer is we just don't know what we're talking about, meaning either we don't understand what the Gemara or the Torah or Chazal actually said. A lot of the time they talk in metaphors. A lot of the time the terminology that's being used is pashut, not the same terminology that we use. So, you know, like the Gemara might say, like, there's a hand. You think it's a hand. It means there's like a handle or something. It can be misinterpreted. Another possibility is that Nishtana Teva. We have examples of this that are bichlal, impossible to dispute. The most obvious one, again, coming from Nida, is there's a machlokas tanoim. If a woman has a veses she'eno kavua, one tana holds she's usher to get married. Why? He says you just can't play around with it. If you don't know when she's going to see dam, then you can't marry her. Right? It was only geboit. It was based on the fact that everyone had a veses kavua. There was it was kemat impossible to find, and he held that the one person in 10,000 that didn't, so you can't marry her. She's one of those people that it's too scary of a situation to get into. Nowadays, it's very rare to find the person who does have a veses kavua. Even when they do, usually, almost always, it happened to be they saw three times in a row, but they never come back to it. And she has more problem. So that's a case of clear nishana teva. A case of the first one, just going back for a second, the Gemara says that there's a machlokas tanaim whether you can kill a louse on Shabbos. You're not allowed to kill things, right? So how come you're allowed to kill a louse on Shabbos? So Rashi brings that. He quotes another Gemara. They're born from dust. Right? Everybody knows lice are born from dust. Straightforward, correct? You pull out a little hair and you see the egg on it. And if you take it to a laboratory and you stick a little microscope on it, you see that it hatches into a baby louse. And it has baby louse diapers and baby louse baby gifts. No, it doesn't. So what are you going to do with that? So really, you know, People come up like this is like a brand new question. The Gemara asks this question because it says Hashem is zon mi karne re'emim ad beit zekinim until the beitzim of a louse. So the Gemara gives all sorts of different answers. The interesting answer is the Gemara in Shabbos says a beit zekinim is a bria. There's a creation called beit zekinim. Well, what does that mean? Pashup shot is there's some other animal out there that's called a beit zekinim and has nothing to do with the louse. Haha, you made a mistake. Does that make sense? L'chor, the pshat is, I'll even add on, this is almost for sure the pshat, and I've spoken this over with Tamid Chachamim, is when it says a louse is born from the dust, what it means is l'nin ator l'malachai asharis. We paskin based on what we see. If something doesn't, if you can't visibly watch it create another child, then it doesn't have a Torah's din of being born from that egg. Nobody back in those days was studying a louse egg with a microscope. We knew there were lice eggs. You ever see one hatch? It came out impossible. So halachically speaking, they were done as if they weren't born from the eggs. Elamai, what is a beitzei kinim? It's a separate bria. It doesn't count as the same thing. So there are times when we don't understand Chazal. There are times when times have changed. And there are also times when the current model of science is incorrect. A good example is that, I don't know if you know this, but 200 years ago the world was flat. How do I know? Because scientists said so. The world was flat 200 years ago. Pitom, a little while after, it had changed. Now the world's not flat. It's crazy how it works. They had big earthquakes at the time as things were like changing. But anybody who's a bar seichel knows the world wasn't flat 200, or was it 400, excuse me, years ago. It was just people didn't know it. So there are times when there's an assumption that's made and then it's changed. The first recorded instance of somebody saying, hey, wait a second, there's somebody making an assertion, I can actually test this and find out whether or not it's true, was actually Rabag. Rabag made a statement. He says, Aristotle said that the sun revolves around the earth. He published this. This is not like, you know, like a Jewish legend. You can look it up on Wikipedia. Right? He said, wait a second, I can test this. And he devised a test to see if it was true. And he saw that it didn't work out. And he published statements saying, look, you know, Aristotle says X, Y, Z, he's the big bar yada in these matters. And I don't know what to do with it, because l'chora it's wrong. The assertion was against the helios, the geocentric theory. Copernicus. Sorry? Against? Thank you. I'm getting my names mixed up. That's why I'm the expert. Yeah. Yeah. Rabag.
When was the Rabag?
Rabag was, I think, I want to say that he was pre-Rambam, but he was in that Tkufa. He was one of the Rishonim who was criticized for being too philosophical. So it was in that, right. They named a crater on the moon after him, you should know. Agav, right? So science holds him too. They call it, there's a crater on the moon named Rabbi Levi. Okay, they missed the Bag part. So what happened with that? The answer is nothing happened with that. Nobody was ready for the idea of saying, let's analyze what somebody else said and then test it. There was this whole welt in the Goyish world that, yeah, okay, somebody who's big says something, and now we're accused of that. Like in the Yiddish world, when a Gadol said something, everybody's like, oh, okay. Right? Like the whole Gemara, which is filled with questions and answers, didn't exist. That's not true. Yiddishkeit is about asking questions and thinking things through. So that's the second problem. The third problem is, there's a famous French philosopher by the name of René Descartes. Descartes is most famous for saying, anybody?
I think therefore I am.
Thank you. I think therefore I am. Right? How do I know that I really exist? Maybe I don't exist. This is the type of things that happen that when you smoke a lot of weed. When, I'm kidding. I usually work with kids at risk. You should just... Descartes said, I think therefore I am. Like, you know, because I'm a bar seichel, so I know that l'pachus I exist. I don't know if you exist. So, like, you know, you'll pardon me if I don't care too much about it. But at least I exist. Right? He also said something else which people don't necessarily know outside of the world of, like, philosophers and things. There's called a Cartesian standard of proof. The Cartesian standard is nothing can prove that this is wrong. Nothing. The chlal. I don't care what crazy hypothesis you bring, I have an answer for it. And if you can't prove it to me, I can say, that's why he needed to say, I think therefore I am. You should just know. Like, you know, the fact that I see myself here, yeah, maybe it's a dream. Well, who's dreaming? I don't know. It could be some crazy thing. Until you come up with a momish 1,000,000% proof, it's not good enough. That's a Cartesian standard. So the thing is, you have to realize is that human beings don't actually work that way. Nobody works that way. If you go to your doctor and he says there's a 99% chance that you need an operation, 1% chance that we're just cutting into your body for no reason, right? Will you go for it? No, prove it to me. I'd rather die on the 1%. Nobody does like that. We think in terms of what's reasonable, what's intelligent, what makes sense. We don't insist that if I can come up with some crazy, you know, Megillah to tie you up, then it's on equal footing with something that's well-based and thought out. That principle, grata, happens not to be particularly relevant to this discussion, because everything is pretty much on equal footing. But you just have to realize that what we're looking for is the intelligent, reasonable shot. Not, I can't think of anything else that's mocks issue. Alright, so that's call number three. As far as the age of the universe goes, starting from the Garish belt, you know, Mylan B'Kodesh Shlomo Ridin, there used to be three different pshatim in how everything came to be the way it is, and the age of the universe would depend on that, those three different pshatim. The first pshat was, things are like this because they've always been like this and nothing's ever changed. Sometimes you feel like that when you wake up, you know, like after a long day. Nothing's ever changed. It's called the static theory. People have always been around, there have always been kings, there have always been people dying, people are born, people die, nothing ever changes. People didn't have population statistics back then. They didn't see that people were growing, things were changing, there hadn't been that much of a change in technology, so this was a legitimate, valid possibility, right? Who knows? Maybe nothing really ever has changed. The second possibility was called the balloon theory. The balloon theory is that we have a Big Bang, and everything explodes outwards, right? Why the Big Bang happened, we'll come up to. And slowly, 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 gravity starts to catch up with it. And eventually it hits a spot where gravity stops the explosion, pulls it back in, and it gets faster and faster and faster until it's moving mamash like incredible speeds. Everything hits it. And it hits so hard that it explodes outward again. And that's basically the history of forever. It's back and forth and back and forth. It's called the oscillating theory. That was what it's called. Because it circles. The oscillating theory was also pretty popular for a while. Both of those, you can readily imagine, both of those possibilities could exist without anything ever doing anything, right? They both basically mean things have been the same forever. It's just one is the same with a certain degree of fluctuation, and the other is the same mamish. The third theory was the classic Big Bang that everybody's heard about. Everything was like a little speck, and then pitom it exploded. And why did it explode? I don't know. That's the correct answer. The scientifically accurate, valid answer is, with the shoulder shrug, I don't know. Because of that, there is a postulation in this theory, a suggestion that we have here an unknown force, which is powerful enough to create, not just to make something explode, because later B'dikot have shown that the universe actually came into being at that moment of the Big Bang. So to create space, matter, energy, and time. I used to think that time wasn't a part of this. Dr. Schroeder told me that I was wrong. I spoke to him, I think, 10 years ago at a discovery seminar. I said, wait a second, you can't say that. What about this? He says, no, that's included too. Oh, okay. I don't know. So space, matter, energy, and time. Right? We're all created by a force that we don't know about. We have heard of a force that creates space, matter, energy, and time. We refer to it as Ribono Shel Olam. So the idea is, look, if it keeps working, then it didn't ever need to get created. It just always was like that. Very similar to the static theory. The question is, the whole universe was constantly doing this since forever and until forever. Right, so there's no like, you are here. On a line stretching to infinity, you can't have a map. Right? In infinity.
How can you manage existence if the universe has exploded out?
Well, so the assumption is that it would take, you know, Bonagid, a few trillion years for everything to happen. So humanity exists in the interim. We're like a temporary aberration by accident. And it could be that sometimes there are no humans, it could be that sometimes there are weird humans with like arms growing out of their forehead, it could be anything. But in fact, their mistama is everything, because on a line stretching to infinity, all possibilities are equally valid. Meaning, it doesn't matter if it's a 1 in a trillion chance. If you have an infinite number of chances, then 1 in a trillion is pretty likely. Right? Correct? There's actually a theory, this is not on our topic, but there's another problem that comes very similar to the issues of like the argument of design. There's a problem that comes up in physics itself. The laws of physics are apparently too geschmack for the development of life to be random. And there's a big argument about it. Some people say it's not so geschmack, not so pushit, things could have been. Some people say, okay, but you know, like even if it's 1 in a trillion chance, like, you know, it happened so clearly, you know, that's the way it was. Unlikely things do happen now and then, right? The a theory that's gaining a lot of popularity is called, give me a second, pardon me while I use my research tool. It's called the the anthropic principle. The anthropic principle means, essentially, the argument goes like this. For any anthropic argument means that, lamashal, if I go into a shul, it's not funny that I'm going to find this follower. Right? If you're in a location where something exists, you expect it to be that type of location that supports that. Right? So, you know, if I'm on a beach, I shouldn't be like, oh, wow, sure it's hot over here. Right? You can expect that the place where you go, so the same way here, the argument goes, look, if you find human beings, then it makes sense that you'll find things that support the development of human life. That's the weak form of the anthropic principle. It just explains why Dafka we ended up on a place that's very good for us to be. Right? Because we wouldn't have ended up in a place that wasn't good for us to be because we wouldn't have developed. That's the weak version. The strong version touches on what we were discussing, which is like, well, Lamaisa, why are there places that promote human life? They seem very unlikely. So the answer is, we're back to infinity. There's not just that there's an infinite number amount of time, there's an infinite number of universes. Each universe has a different set of laws of physics, and how many different possibilities are there? Infinity! Right? So if there's an infinite number of possibilities, then we got lucky and landed on this one. But probably there's somebody somewhere who's really suffering because in his universe, you know, it doesn't support life so well and he's like choking to death. To get back to the real world for a second, there is a like dividing line between science and non-science, right? And it basically amounts to if you can prove or disprove something, then it's a postulate that science is willing to consider. If you can't prove it, it falls into the degraded and horrible category referred to as religion, right, that nobody likes, because you can't prove it. So, like, why are you bringing it up? You're just making stuff up to have fun with me, right? We consider it exactly the opposite. Most of our religion comes from, like, direct observation, which is a proof, historical record, which is provable, right? So that's something that's provable. The anthropic principle, which states that there are millions and an infinite number of universes, none of which can be seen or detected in any way, shape, or form, that's not provable. Right? In fact, it's part of the theory that you can't prove it. So one guy answered, well, maybe we'll learn how to prove it someday. Okay. How about these three different models of the age of the universe, right? The static model, the oscillating model, and the Big Bang theory. So what ended up happening was like this. In the early 1900s, people were able to come to the conclusion that the static theory is no good. They did it on two different reasons that they decided that it was no good. The first reason was Einstein's theory of relativity conflicted with it. It wouldn't work. The physics of the theory of relativity wouldn't work in a universe that stayed the same all the time. It had to be expanding. Now, if something's expanding, right, all you have to do is think back, what would it look like a few million years ago, and you know that it originally started off a lot smaller. So that implies that the static theory is incorrect. Eventually, they just said it can't be. Right? In 1925, Edwin Hubble basically released the finding that every galaxy within 100 million light years of the Earth was expanding. So that basically said, okay, the static theory is gone, now we've got two left. At that point, Einstein got a little bit concerned. Because he said, look, Fish Lemma, you have the oscillating model, so everything can be fine. If you're going to find it, though, the Big Bang theory, so what started it? He started to get nervous, and he had a famous line, I don't like the idea that God is playing dice with the universe. Right? It doesn't seem like a dice-playing type of thing, L'chora. It would be very, very precise. But that was his line. In other words, he was nervous about this. As far as the oscillating universe, so there's two problems with it. Problem number one is entropy. Everybody familiar with that term? Well, you're familiar because you're a scientist. Anybody else? Entropy means that in every single reaction, a little bit of whatever it started with, it doesn't disappear, but it's not useful anymore. The most obvious example of this is if you build a building, right? So not every speck of wood that you buy ends up going into the building. In fact, if you're a little bit sloppy, I know because I used to hang out around building sites, you can get mamish tons of wood from the dumpsters that these guys threw up because they cut off a tiny piece. It's not useful anymore because it's not the right shape, it's not the right size, it's got holes in it, it's still wood, but it's not usable anymore. Entropy means every time something happens, a little bit of the useful stuff disappears. So what that means is you can't keep having a universe exploding inward and outward and inward and outward. Because eventually, there's not enough energy in the collapse to push it back out again. So it's not infinite. The difference is over here, is with a ball, gravity is stronger than the power of the bounce. So that's not an even reaction. But even in an even reaction, entropy, look, you know, like a few stray molecules are going to escape every time. Some of the energy is going to fly off into the great unknown. You know, like, it's not going to catch up. But more importantly, when was this? I think it was in the 1978. So a guy by the name of Jastrow, not the one that we've heard of, declared that the third model was probably correct because for like 20 years before that, they'd been showing that there was not enough matter in the universe to create a gravitational pull that would stop the outward expansion. That means that this was a one-time shot. If there's a one-time shot, then it started at one point, and it's never going to finish. And the current predictions, I saw in a book by Dr. Robert Shapiro from 84, he says that XYZ gazillion years, so it's going to be expanded to the point where every single atom has light years between it and the next atom. Right? There's no pulling back together. Don't get scared, it's too long away. Okay, so that brings us to the question, fine, so at some point, the universe was created, and it exploded outward, and great, so now we're here. How long ago was that? So, this is where you get into the discussion of, people think it's called radiocarbon dating. Radiocarbon dating is a particular type of radiometric dating, and we have to get into the discussion, because it's really not carbon dating so much that's a problem. All right, but first let's just get through what that means. Let's see what time it is here. Wow, kind of hard. Okay. Radiometric dating means like this. There are various types of particles that are radioactive, and that means that every once in a while, one of those particles will decay. It'll change into a different particle by shooting off a part of it into wherever. It's very dangerous. A person stands in the way of these things, causes cancer. Radiometric dating is various ways of figuring out how long has this been going on. How long has it been decaying? So, LaMarche, with carbon dating, there's two types of carbon in the world. We breathe in every day. There's carbon-12 and carbon-14. Carbon-14 is radioactive, carbon-12 is not, and they exist in fixed quantities in the atmosphere. That means that as long as you are breathing, right, you keep on replenishing the supply of carbon-12 and carbon-14, the ratios are going to stay the same. When a person, an animal, whatever, dies, they stop breathing, they stop replenishing the ratios. So carbon-12 stays the same, it doesn't go anywhere. Carbon-14 starts to break down. So if you can look at the ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-14 in a fossil, and you see that it's broken down XYZ amount, and you know how long it takes for it to break down that much, the theory goes, you can figure out how long it's been dead for. And that's what how people date, you know, like dinosaur bones and whatnot. Radiometric dating in general, radiocarbon dating, LaMarchal, is carbon dating, any radioactive particle decays based on what's called a half-life. That means that not this many particles shoot off every 10 minutes, but by this amount of time, it'll have lost one half of what it has, and then another time, it's not a straight progression, it sort of tapers off. So you have to know what the half-life is and figure out how many times it's halved. Radiocarbon dating has a half-life of 5,730 years, which means that by literal reading of the Torah, we've just basically passed one half-life. Okay? Radiocarbon dating is said to be accurate for ages up to about 60,000 years. That means that if you want to prove that something's a billion, trillion years old because you don't like Jews, you're not going to use radiocarbon dating. So it's really out of the picture for our purposes. I only brought it up because people always talk about carbon dating to you like that's the big deal. Obviously it is. If you say something 60,000 years old, it's also a problem. But the truth is that when you get to like the million-year range, so that sort of falls by the wayside. There's the one that's used a lot is called... Can't remember it offhand. Doesn't matter. Right. The one that's used a lot, the comparison is different. Right. There's no assumption that we're dealing with a living creature. So you can't say, well, as long as he's been breathing. There's no stable form of the same thing to compare against. But what we say is, it doesn't decay into something that's naturally there. So I can see how much of what it decayed into is there, and find out from that what the original total was, and then I can still figure out how long it's been decaying. That's the assumption. Alright, so for this type of thing, just so you know, radiocarbon dating has been around since 1905, when it was invented by Ernest Rutherford, right? The Rutherford model of the atom. Okay. Rutherford created it. At the time, it said the Earth was really old, you know, like a few million years old. As they perfected the methodology and as things got a little bit more precise, so it got worse. Now they say the Earth is, you know, a lot longer, a lot older. Billions of years. I think it's 2 billion years old for the Earth, and 12 to 17 billion years old for the universe. Okay? So that puts us into the question, like, you know, how do we read Bereshis Bara Elokim Yesod Shamayim V'Sa'aretz? Right? Good. So that's the question. There are all sorts of different possibilities out there. We're going to focus on the ones that are actually Mesorati. There are a few places in Rishonim and Meforshim where you find things that mimic, talking about a long time ago, not you know, like in response to these types of challenges, where you find things that sound very similar to the theory of evolution, the billion-year-old age to the universe, etc. Specifically, I've seen quotes, although not inside, from the Radal in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer and the Mor Nevuchim, both of which describe things that sound similar to evolution and how long it took. The idea being that the story of the creation of the universe, which it says took 7 days, isn't necessarily a literal 7 days, could be a lot longer. But, you know, like Naniach Etzeh, you can decide to like it or not. I haven't seen the sources inside, so I can't be more precise about it. There is a very clear source, however. This comes from Rav Aryeh Kaplan. He thought this was very cool. There's a well-known Kabbalah sefer called Sefer HaTemuna. Came up very early on. And he said that everybody knows, you know, Chazal say we're in a cycle of 7,000 years. So Sefer HaTemuna said that is part of a larger cycle of seven. So there's a total of actually 49,000 years. There's a machlokas in the Mekubalim, which one of the cycles we're in now. Libnas HaSapir, which was in the 13th century, wrote that we're in the last one. That means we have 42,000 years of prehistory before now. Okay, cool, right? 42,000 years. That's not quite a few billion, but we're getting there. So Rav Yitzchak de Min Akko, who lived around the same time as Ramban, wrote, no, it's not shot in Sefer HaTemuna that there's actually seven cycles of seven. All the years up until our cycle were Yom Echad, Ke'al Shonim Be'inecha, Ki'yom Esmo Ki'yavur. 1,000 years in your eyes, Hashem, is like a day. So really, every single day that we're counting in these 42,000 years is really 1,000 years. That means that you multiply your year, right? Your 42,000 years, you're going to multiply each one of those years by 365,250. Because if each day is a year, then a full year is 365,250 years, because a year is 365 1/4 days. That puts us at 15 billion years. Okay? 15.34 billion years. Since the current estimate for the universe is between 12 and 17 billion years old, that fits us very neatly in. Okay, if that's your thing, you know, Gzunta Hay, I hope that you enjoy it. My problem with that is that A, most of the Farshim don't seem to take that stance. It's very, very rare. In fact, the Ramban Dafka writes, he says, you should know, this is the quote, that the 7 days of creation means 7 days 24 hours, like we have now. Something like that. Okay, Ramban was no slouch in the world of Kabbalah. He didn't make stuff up. So how do you read the Torah? Not only that, but it doesn't seem mashma in the psukim. So what are you going to do? So here comes the more interesting question, I think. And the question goes like this. This is the way that a guy named Henry Gass put the question, but you can think of really interesting versions of the same question. The question is like this. Did Adam HaRishon have a belly button? Anybody? Right? Ask you, Taina, that he had a belly button. I don't understand. Who was he nursing from before he was born? But if he didn't have a belly button, he's not a human being. Right? That's the kasha. So his taina was, it wouldn't be shlemus for Adam to be born without a navel. Elamai, he had a navel. That's his argument. And by extension, a lot of things, which we'll talk about in a second. I just want to point out that for a yid, this is not like an argument, kasha, teretz, whatever. The Gemara actually says in Rosh Hashanah, Yod Aleph, Amud Aleph. Where is it? Says every I can't find it off the top of my head naturally, right? But yeah, it's at the top of the page. Everything was created, and here's the lashon: bekomasan nivru. They are created with their coma. So Rashi says, v'hainu, in other words, pre eitz piri. It wasn't just an eitz; it was an eitz piri. It was already ready to give birth. If anybody asked you which came first, the chicken or the egg, this is the teretz. Everything was created fully formed, complete, and ready to go. So Mimewa, human beings were created as adults, with belly buttons, kiyu, like you know, a work in progress. The Gemara says the same thing, actually, in Chav Vav Menelof. The Gemara says, from Pasuk Batitiv La Hashem Mishor Par, that it's better for Hashem than a shor par. The problem is that one of those terminologies refers to a baby, and the other refers to a full-grown animal. So the Gemara says, when Adam Rishon saw that things were going well, he brought a shor, and the shor was a par. He brought an animal that was one day old, but fully formed. Okay? You can ask the same question with the same tirets about trees. Every year a tree has a ring. So if you have eitz peri, that it was already grown and ready to bear fruit, right? What would have happened if Adam would have, like, you know, I don't know, found the, took the tongs that Hashem created by Ben Hashmashos, made himself a nice axe, whacked down a tree, what was he going to see? You can see rings, right? That's the way that the world works. The world doesn't—it didn't like pop into existence, surprise, and everything looked weird. It looked exactly the way it looks now. That's part of the game. Not only were there rings on trees, but Hashem also created an animal called a vulture. What does a vulture eat? Dead animals. So Adam Rishon is walking around. He sees a dead animal on the ground. He says, "Oh, I must have missed the first few years." No, of course not. That's part of the world. The world needed dead animals for vultures to eat. The trees needed rings. And not only that, there are mosses that eat dead trees. So there were dead trees. But if you can go even farther from that. If somebody would have picked up a diamond, they don't know exactly how long it takes for a diamond to be formed, but it's a long time. Right? So somebody picked up a diamond, you know, in prehistory, before the invention of radiometric dating. Oh, this is a diamond. It takes 10,000 years to form. Shema Amina, the world was 10,000 years old. Does that make sense? Kamuvan not. Right? You could say the same thing about rocks. Rocks were formed from molten lava. Not every single one of them, but some of them. So, must be a long time ago there was like a big explosion, and since there's no volcanoes around here, must be like a long back history. Of course not. But it gets even deeper than that. That's the truth. If you do not go to sleep at night, like a lot of the guys that I work with, right, and you're not in the city where you're blinded by the street lights, and you look up, you will see these great, cool things called stars. Right? How many are there? A lot. If you go into the desert and you look up, you will see a lot more. It's just unbelievable. Right? How do we see these stars? How far away are they? They are in some cases hundreds, thousands, millions of light years away. Right? That means that if things were left to their own devices, it would take hundreds, thousands, millions of years for the light to get to us. Right? But Hashem obviously wanted us to be able to see stars, right? Elamai, there was a back history that was created. The light from the stars was created 99% of the way there, 100% of the way there, whatever you want to call it. Light from a star carries with it radiation. Not just the light that you see, but there's other types of radiation. People who suffer skin diseases because they spend too much time out in the sun know this. That means that if the light from the stars was created all the way here, it also had to have partially decayed radiation coming all the way there, or again, it would be disingenuous. It wouldn't fit with the rest of the model. So we already have a back history of millions of years that's Muzman Zug, and you have to say, before you get to anything else about, well, maybe this, well, maybe that, why didn't I say this? And the truth is, the whole discussion of radiometric dating is just another take on the same old question. If I see something that's old, why didn't you just look at Adam Arishon? He looked like a 40-year-old or whatever it is. So pitom you see, Shema Amino, the Earth was 40 years. Of course you're going to see signs of age. It's not even a discussion. The truth is, therefore, that the whole sugi of radiometric dating was never relevant to the question of how valid is the Torah. We'll come to that. Thank you. So that's my general argument. When people come up to me with these questions about, like, you know, what about the age of the universe? The question is, like, first of all, whatever you want to tie in there, either the Earth is a billion years old or it's not. Either way, you have a Makor to back you up, so what do you care? The question is really irrelevant, because even if the world is 5,770 years old plus 7 days, or whatever it is, 73 years old, excuse me, doesn't matter. Of course, you're going to see a larger chain of events than that. Right? Even the Gemara says it was all Machshava 6 months before that. Hashem was thinking, what does it mean Hashem was thinking about creation for 6 months before He created time? I don't know. But there was clearly a back history involved. Okay. The problem is that for some reason people are like, yeah, but I don't know. We say 5,773, they say 12 billion. What are you going to do with that? So we just said what we're going to do with that. But just to discuss for a second how radiometric dating works, what there is to discuss about it. Oh, excuse me, I just wanted to point out, while we're on the subject of the stars, interesting Ramban at the beginning of Sefer Bereishis, you know, this was like a metziah, you know? Like, just as we were rolling to print, I found this, I was like, stop the presses! The Ramban says, the pasuk says, Hashem created the ma'oros le'ha'ir al ha'aretz. He created the stars to give light to the earth. Right, the Ramban Akasha. Yeah, of course, what did you expect? That He created the stars for nothing? He says, no, Hashem needed to create them dafka in such a way that the light would hit the earth. It could have been that the stars would never shine on us. In other words, right, translating for a few 800 years into the future, right, Hashem, that pasuk means He made the light 99% of the way there. Sorry? Leha'ir al ha'aretz. To provide light on the earth. It says it twice, actually. Rabban only says it on one of the two pasuk. Okay, so a few comments though on radiometric dating in general. Like we said, it was invented in 1905. There's been a lot of discussion about it, a lot of change since then. There are whole libraries about radiometric dating, which I have not gone through. However, the first question that everyone asks when they're confronted with radiometric dating is, well, like, how sure are we that everything stays the same? And how do you know that the different periods of the radioactive breakdown don't change? So the first point is, look, we've known about this for 107 years. So yeah, there's a lot to not know. There are types of radioactive isotopes that decay in a few seconds, right? Those aren't relevant really for aging the universe. But, you know, even radiocarbon dating, which is considered one of the short, long ones, right? It has a half-life of 5,700 years. That means that we've been around for one half-life. So how much can we really say that we know? Okay, that's one thing. Another point that's been brought up is, well, how do you know that it hasn't been changing on a relative basis for the whole time? Maybe it started off really fast, and as time progresses, it's slowing down. Okay, that's a possibility, but it's not as much of a possibility as we would like to think. And the reason why is because you can compare. You can say, look, I have this light coming from Yena star, which is, you know, a light year away from us. That means that this radioactivity has been breaking down for a year, right? So based on the current rate of decay, it should look like this. If it doesn't look like this, then I know that things are changing. It hasn't changed. But you can also compare the breakdown of different types of isotopes in the same thing to see if something's been fiddling with it. Do the two of them correlate? And usually they do. So that's not so puzzling. What is interesting is there was a guy named Emery who put together a study called Perturbations of Nuclear Decay Rates in 1972. And he found out that, yeah, you could talk a change the rate at which a radioactive isotope decays. Not a lot. In fact, so not a lot that it's considered to be non-significant. But yeah, you could change them. How? So it's related to extremes of temperature and pressure. So as he pointed out, we had this thing called a mobble. Geysers were shooting out of the earth at temperatures that were extraordinarily hot. Rain was flushing down from the top. Water pressure is very, very high. If you read Rashi, it says basically that Hashem was kemat machzer es ha'olam l'tohu v'vohu. The pasuk says vayimach es kol yikum, he wiped out the whole planet. Sforno says that was when the earth tipped on its axis. Right? Originally, the world was spinning like this. Now it's spinning like this. Very interesting. So it could very well be, excuse me, it could very well be that at that point there was a lot of high temperatures, a lot of high pressure. We don't really know what was going on. A lot of crazy things happened. There's a possibility that at some point during that event, which lasted, you know, you read it in Parshas Noach, it takes about 10 minutes. It lasted for a year. And the whole time, all these things are going on. Everything's dead. Everything's like, you know, we lost 3 tefachim of ground. So yeah, 10 tefachim, excuse me. So yeah, it's possible that we can posit that some things changed over there, and they could have changed at a standard rate. Not, you know, like, oh, this one lost a little bit, this one lost a lot, so then why do they still correlate? But it could have been lost by statistical whole. It's interesting to note that radioactive decay, has this funny thing about it. You know, when something decays like this, you have to ask yourself, this is one of the things that bothers particularly quantum physics, is who told this molecule to decay and that one didn't? There's really nothing. LMI, what? They're collaborating. They're like, they get together. So what? They get together in like a staff meeting. Okay, everybody, you know, budget cuts have been really hitting everybody hard. We're making a few layoffs today. You know, we're going to make this totally random so that nobody feels the pinch. You know, you, Mr. Isotope here, and you, I'm sorry, you know, we'll give you a good review, but you got to go. Who decides which ones decay? It's mamish totally random from a scientific perspective. But they seem to know, like, how many left so that they can readjust how many are going to leave. Okay, so that's a little bit funny. I'm just suggesting that in extreme changes of temperature and pressure, the seasons also change, by the way, by the mobile. Up until then, there was like a very, very nice, calm progression of seasons. And then Pitom afterwards, we have like, you know, winter outside, and I'm cold. Okay. Another point. There are two interesting Makairis. Am I running out of time? No, actually not. There are two interesting Makairis that argue connected radiometric dating. The first one of them is the astronomical age given to the universe. Right? I read a quote from a guy named Fred Hoyle. Everybody's heard of Fred Hoyle in these types of arguments because he's a very, very well-known physicist. He's won the Nobel Prize. He's also cuckoo. So you just have to be careful how you quote him. He's clearly brilliant. He also has some very, very weird theories. I just found a book of his. I started to read it because it was interesting. He posits that that aliens created other aliens that created other aliens that created human beings. Right? So, okay, you know. But in any case, so he's writing about questions of the age of the universe. He says, in 1947, when I first began to ponder it, the geologist Arthur Holmes was asserting with immense courage that the measured age of the universe, of the Earth, excuse me, was greater than the age of the entire universe as then given with confidence by Edwin Hubble. One therefore needed little in the way of an inquiring mind to start pondering, right? Although astronomers have since increased Hubble's age estimate about fivefold, much the same situation exists today. In other words, what he's saying is, and this is in 1982, that in 1982 at least, the estimate for the age of the whole universe was not as big as radiometric dating placed the age of the Earth. Okay, that's a problem. The other one is the Egyptian pottery record. Physicists and radiometric daters in particular hate the pottery record. It's like a big fight between them, who's right. The pottery record works like this. You learn a lot about a culture, and you use dating methods, like, you know, what it says was the date in their staros, You know, like that's a pretty valid, legitimate system for dating, right? You're not going to figure that everybody lied so that scientists a few hundred years later would you know, not get it. And what you come up with is, like, at a certain period in time, people started using this type of pottery. They developed this type of metal. They did this. So you can date things by finding what type of pottery was in the ruins. That's one of the systems. Okay, the Egyptian pottery record, it regularly dates things to be 150 years before radiocarbon dating, or afterwards. For example, radiocarbon tests reveal that Mount Tara, which is an island in Greece, erupted between 1627 and 1600 BCE. Okay, that's a pretty clear date, right? You test it, you get it to within 27 years. However, archaeological excavations found Egyptian and Cypriot pottery, which came from a later period, buried under the ash. So either after the eruption, somebody came up there, dug a big hole, stuck a bunch of Egyptian pottery underneath, and then covered it up, or there's something wrong with one of the two dating systems. I understand that there's a lot of negative feelings between these two groups about this. So we'll treat it with a little bit of sensitivity and leave it with that, but it's something to think about also. The vial, what we have here is essentially like this. And this is really how it comes together. First of all, the whole question is not really relevant. No offense to everybody who came to listen to me. You know, either the universe existed for 15 billion years, which we have a Makor for in Kabbalah, or it existed for 5773 years, which you have a Makor for and an explanation for in the Rishonim. Right? In either case, you're going to see exactly the same signs, so what are you asking about? Noch weiter, it's possible, although not entirely likely, that the whole system needs to be re-evaluated for accuracy. Finally, just to add in a few interesting things, the last I saw this in Rav Aaron Feldman brings down a few likutim. Lashem Shavovach Lama writes that the hours of each day of creation were at least 1,000 times longer than the current standard hour, and the things kept on going like that, but not as much until the Mabul. I don't know where he gets it from, but it's just an interesting thing to think about. Similarly, Rav Shimon Schwab states that, okay, no, hours took an hour, you know, 60 minutes, each minute is 60 seconds, but a lot more happened during that time. So you can look at it one way, you can look at it the other way. Either way, you have it. If you want more information on this, you have to go to the source. We're by it here. Haka. Thank you very much, and I appreciate your listening. See ya. 72 shekels. Well done. You could send me this.
Oh, turn it off.